and welcome to Lunching with Lawyers. Lunching with Lawyers is brought to you by LorettaCrete.com. In this series of podcasts, Loretta explores the world of law graduates. She talks to lawyers, recent law graduates, and budding lawyers seeking alternatives or exploring how to get the jobs that they want. This podcast series is also for those thinking about pivoting or just wanting to do something different. So join Loretta for discussions with lawyers and law graduates about their careers and the paths they took to get to where they are. Let's explore what success in their profession looks like to them.
Hello everybody, it's Loretta here with her next episode of Lunching with Lawyers, and today Angelika Kopecz, who recently left the Australian Bridal Industry Association after 9 years holding the position of National Manager of Sales and Marketing, is here with me. Today I'm going to talk to her about how her law degree propelled her into a career in sales and marketing. Welcome, Angelika. Have I got that right?
Yes, you definitely have. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, and of course, we're always enjoying a glass of wine, and today it's a glass of red because it is called Lunching with Lawyers. So, Angelika, your family migrated from communist Poland. So, mm-hmm. When did they leave?
They left, I think it was like 5 years before I was born. So, I would say early 1980s. Like 7 years or something like that. So I know that my great-grandmother was the first one that came here to Australia, and we were the second to come. But it's such an interesting story, and I didn't know much about it until I turned 18, because my father was in the police force, and back in those days you couldn't actually leave the country.
Yes, I know.
Well, in general, but especially as a police officer. And when I turned 18, my parents told me that I actually have another part of my family in Poland. My dad had another sister that was given up for adoption, and she was very, very high up in the police force, and she actually helped him escape. But he was obviously not allowed to say anything because we don't know what could have happened to her. So it was a very unusual story. Being an only child as well, to find out that he had another part of your family on the other side of the world. It was very exciting.
So were they cousins?
They were cousins, yeah. And it's a weird age gap as well, because it was like my dad's sister plus she has a child, and then they have children, and my auntie's son, which is, I would say, my cousin, he's getting married now. So he's my age. So yeah, it's just interesting story how everything came about.
And so did they come to Australia because there was already the great grandmother here?
Yes, I believe there was only a choice of Australia and America. And then they just made that pivotal decision at the airport and decided to come to Australia.
Isn't that funny? At the airport?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were saying it was last minute because they were on a flight out with another couple that was Polish, and that couple happened to go to America. They came here, and I actually just recently found out that their daughter has my first name as their middle name, and I have her first name as my middle name. So that's the impact that somebody made on them whilst they were just on a flight together.
And why did they decide to go? Like, what drove them from Poland?
Better life.
Yeah.
Dad's told me so many times that he just wanted to find a woman that wanted to leave. And obviously it's a struggle when you live in communities like that. You know, no one wants to go outside the norm. It's very scary to think of what could be out there. He met my mom. They fell in love, and she really wanted to leave the country, and they just decided to do it.
You know, it's surprising, as I was speaking to you just before the podcast, that, you know, I haven't interviewed that many people for this podcast, but already there's so many people that have come from overseas and are only first-generation migrants, myself included.
Yeah.
So, And I know my father made the same choice between America and Australia, and he chose Australia, but he chose Australia because at that time they were still providing free flights to Australia.
Maybe he left that bit out.
But this was, my parents came in the 60s.
Oh, right. But I wouldn't be surprised anyway.
So, as you said, you were born in Australia from, and you're the only child.
Yes.
And you said it was tough growing up here.
Yes.
Why?
So, my parents first came to Melbourne, and then my mum's side of the family came, and then my dad's side of the family came. So, our essentially extended family ended up living in Melbourne. And when I was eight, my parents made the decision to leave Melbourne and come to the Gold Coast. Uh-huh. So I guess that's where it started becoming quite difficult because, A, you have an only child that's leaving all of her cousins, and B, you're coming to the Gold Coast where there's no multiculturalism. In Melbourne, it was just, you know, every single culture you could ever think of. It was just a kaleidoscope of people and it was amazing. And I actually couldn't speak English until I went to school. So for me, Polish was my first language. Coming to the Gold Coast and going to a school where I was probably the only person that was of a background that wasn't Australian, it was very, very difficult. So even from something as silly as what I had to eat for lunch, people would make fun of me. So it was,
and
it was
just such a, it's such a common thing. I never wanted to show my lunch to anyone.
I know.
I love that food.
I know. I'm like, I can't help it. I like sausage.
All I wanted was to have to be like the others and have white bread with lunch.
I know. I guess it's a common thing that a lot of people from different backgrounds go through, but I know the Gold Coast has definitely changed. I mean, it's been 30 years since then, so 25 years.
Yeah, so it's a lot different place.
Yeah.
I would agree. I don't think it's the same place as it would have been.
But I mean, there's a reason why everything happens. I think for me, if I didn't go through that, I wouldn't have been driven to books like I was. So I guess it was a combination of thinking, oh my God, my parents came from, you know, nothing. They left what they had to come to a country like Australia. It's my responsibility to make the best of myself and prove that there was a reason why they came here. And obviously, I had no friends. It was very hard for me. So I just went to the library and studied and just wanted to be the best that I could be.
Wow. Is that why you chose law?
Yes, I think so. Just to, I guess, make my parents proud. As silly as it sounds, and I think a lot of people do go through that same thing. It was definitely a pride thing, definitely. And I guess the other reason was I wasn't sure what I wanted to do as well. And very, very, very strict upbringing, which meant I didn't really go out and do much. So for me, books became my everything, and I just fell in love with reading and learning and just wanting to know everything about everything. And I guess that just led me to go into law, because it was the most important for me. I thought it was like the peak of what you could do with your life.
Isn't it funny, because I probably had a similar thing in that I love books and I was always at the library. And in fact, that's what I wanted to be.
A librarian. <That's cute. laughs>
But I probably was driven similarly because of that. Well, mine was more because of a poor background, but also that wanting to do your best.
Yeah.
And wanting to do something that would lift me out of that poverty. And, you know, so that people would look at me and go, well, that woman has status.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a status thing too, because when you come from, you know, a non-English speaking background and people look down upon you.
Yeah, they definitely do, yeah.
Yeah. Then you don't want that for your future.
No. Yeah, of course.
So why did you choose Griffith to go to university?
Oh, gosh. I think it was just a case of when I was in my later part of high school, I was part of a program with Griffith University, and I had a really, really lovely lady be my mentor, And I think that was just the journey that I was taking, and because it was aligned with Griffith, it just made sense to me to go to Griffith. Yeah. So I did have my eye on Bond, but I don't know, everything in my being just said you should go with Griffith. So yeah.
But Griffith wasn't that easy for you, was it?
No, Griffith, I mean, I think everyone has different stories and they go through university, you know, in different ways. But for me, it was tough. I don't know, there was, and this has absolutely nothing to do with Griffith University. I think it's just the way that kids were back in those days. But there was a lot of competition, and some of it may not have been very healthy competition.
Do you think that's any better? Anywhere?
No, definitely not. I guess some people can be brutal about certain things, and I wasn't expecting that at a university. I was expecting that more so at high school, but not at university. But I think it was a good wake-up call to think, hey, this is life, and this is what you're going to get. No matter where you go or what you do in your career, there's always going to be people that want to be on top, and they'll do anything to be on top, and you just need to be the best person you can be.
Well, I think you've gone and done. And you also did a Bachelor of International Business at the same time. Was that because you had to do a combined degree?
Yes.
And so why did you choose business?
I just fell in love with business. So I always felt drawn to business. I felt like I was really good at marketing and sales, even at high school. My father opened up a painting business, so I was exposed to the whole business life very early on. I also had a boyfriend at the time whose parents owned a chain of restaurants. So,
but those boyfriends. They are very good for you or very bad for you.
Yeah, it was actually a funny story because he was quite high up as a business development manager. And when I made the decision that I was going to not go down the career path of law, I saw this job come up, and it was national operations manager. And I do remember him vividly being like, "You do not have enough experience for that." And I was like, that was what I needed to be like, I'm going to show you. And it wasn't that he wasn't supportive, but he just basically posed the question that probably everybody was thinking, like, what makes you think that you can have that job?
And in fact, when I was looking at your resume, I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
I thought, how the hell did she get that position?
Yeah.
So I think we can talk about that a little bit more because I mean that is really fascinating, and it's true that I think people can drive you both positively or negatively. And he wasn't saying anything that anyone else wouldn't have been saying.
I probably would have thought the same thing, but it was just that little push that I needed. I mean, when you ask how did I get it was as simple as me going in there being completely honest and saying to him, my prospective employer, look, you have two choices. You can either employ somebody who has all the skills that you want and pay them X amount, or I'm willing to work for you for this amount because I know that I can prove myself.
So you negotiated your pay first paycheck.
I under-negotiated. And I guess as a businessman, as if you're going to say no to that, what have you got to lose? I guess you've got 3 months for somebody to either prove themselves or not. And I knew, I could feel it inside of me that all I needed was a break. I just needed somebody to take a chance on me. And he did. And within 3 months, I got promoted to general manager.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute because I'm really fascinated about that position that you ended up getting and what it does and how you grew that business, because that is really quite interesting. But let's go back, because you did decide not to pursue a career in straight law. Why did you do that after all this effort?
I feel like there's a lot of people in the same boat when I say this. It was probably by year 3 or 4 that I realized that I was not going to change the world. So that kind of made me feel like, okay, well, if I'm not going to change the world, if I'm not going to be that driving force between good and evil, then I need to stick to business. I couldn't make the changes that I thought that I could make with law. And it kind of smacked me in the face and I realised, wow.
Now, that is sad.
Yeah.
That university did that to you.
Well, it wasn't the university. It really wasn't. It was just my perception of the law. That's how I felt at that age, whether it was because I was immature, I don't know, or whether I had a... I don't know what it was. I just felt within myself that I couldn't make the differences that I wanted to. And it was a combination of going to different... it doesn't really matter. But just it was definitely not the university. It was just a case of I just didn't feel that law allowed me to help people as much as I wanted to help them.
And look, that is really true. I feel blessed that I've been able to do the work that I can for so many years because it's really in a social justice area.
Mm.
But I remember speaking to one of my other interviewees and he was saying, well, he went to Africa thinking he would be able to, you know, solve world poverty and came back and decided to go and become a lawyer.
Oh, there you go. See? Yeah.
Because that was because he decided he was very arrogant in thinking that.
Yeah, I know.
But his fallback position was the law. Your fallback position was business.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, you can make a difference anywhere. And one of the things that's always struck me is that, you know, I look, sometimes people say to me, well, why isn't this law changed? And I go, do you know how much I have worked for this for the last 20 years and we've got one step forward, you know, or a few. There are changes, but it's often very slow.
And I think that was my frustration.
Yeah.
That I just felt like I kept knocking my head and, like, there was nothing that I could do. Whereas when I looked at business, I could make a positive impact on people. So although I wasn't working in business, you know, I would network and I'd sit down with people and speak to them and I could see where their deficiencies were and I'd give them little bits of advice and everyone would always be like, oh my gosh, how do you know this? How do you know this? And it kind of just came instinctively to me. So
now that's really interesting because I really like, I've never been a good networker, I would have to say. And I think that's been one of the skills that I've really lacked for many years. But to have good networking skills when you were young, how did you develop those and what did you do?
I think it was as simple as I was an only child. I need to speak to someone. Otherwise, I'd go insane. I don't know how it developed. I would probably say that I didn't perfect them until I started working at the ABIA. Definitely not. You know, the ABIA's database of businesses is in excess of 15,000. So.
And the ABIA for the audience, because they won't know where you are.
Yes. So the Australian Bridal Industry Academy, and it's recently also been changed to ABIA Weddings.
So we'll talk a bit, because I am fascinated about this. I looked at the website just briefly. Obviously, I think I got married in the year ABIA started, which was 1996.
Yeah.
So
a lot of things have changed.
I think so too.
Yes.
Including having much better access to the internet.
Yes. Yes. Everyone wants to be an Instagram bride. Not everyone can afford it.
Oh, really? Is that the case?
Instagram has made businesses and broken so many businesses.
Especially in the bridal industry.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, so you, even though you decided then that you weren't going to be a lawyer, you still did your diploma of legal practice.
I did.
Through the ANU. Why did you do that? And why the ANU?
The ANU for me had a really good reputation, and it had a very short online course, so I just wanted to bang it out and then go get a job in business. Like, that was my goal.
But, you know, was this your fallback position? Like, if business didn't work, were you going to practice?
Yeah, I always have plan A, B, C, D, E, F, Z. So that's just the kind of person that I am. I wanted to cover all bases. I didn't know how I was going to feel, you know, in 3 months, a year, 5 years, 10 years down the track.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, most people put off doing their practical legal training or their diploma because it's expensive and also because it's time.
Yeah, but I wanted that beautiful plaque and certificate. Just be like, it was not all for nothing. And I would never, ever, ever say it wasn't all for nothing, because I would not be the person I am today. And I probably guarantee I wouldn't have got my job at the ABIA if it wasn't for that as well, because it doesn't just show that I have business acumen. It means that I have discipline.
And drive. And just for the audience, if they don't know, the ANU is the Australian National University in Canberra, but you did it online, so.
Yes.
Now, whilst you were at university, I know you said that this was only a very short period of time, but it's something that fascinates me.
Yes.
I love the Palazzo Versace. And you worked there as a wedding hostess. And so how did you get that job?
Well, it was a hostess for events. How did I get that job? I don't remember how I got that job. I think I was really good in my interview. it was a very unusual role. It was, I guess, being a hostess in the sense that you would serve guests, speak to guests, liaise with guests in events. So whether that guest was a 6 a.m. champagne brunch with sheikhs from Dubai, or whether it was a wedding, or I mean, we had some really interesting ones. We had Jane Fonda.
Oh, really? Yes. Oh, my goodness.
So
my friend would be so jealous, because she still has the old Jane Fonda tapes.
Isn't she looked incredible.
Really?
Incredible. But the funniest thing, I think it was every Tuesday, they had senior ladies get together at 6 a.m. for a brunch, and they would have strippers.
Oh, no,
male strippers. Very classy, very beautiful, but it was just like a real funny kind of thing. I mean, they wouldn't get completely in the buff. It was just like a very fun kind of little addition.
It's
to
making me blush.
Gosh, I hope we're going to get in trouble saying all this stuff. So we would have events, and a big part of that was weddings. So
what was Jane Fonda there for?
She was doing one of the champagne breakfasts. I think maybe she was just promoting something that she was doing at the time. So I can't believe
she was in Australia, you know, that she came that often.
Yeah.
So anyone else famous really stuck in your mind?
There's a lot of things. Well, no, that's probably the most famous one. There were other famous people there, but I didn't personally interact with them, so I guess I don't remember because it was so long ago. There was just a lot of high-profile people. It was a good time. It was very, very intense.
Yes.
Yes. I got some very unusual requests.
What was the most unusual request that you can share?
One gentleman asked me to dip his olives in chocolate. That was a very unusual one. I was like, okay, I draw the line at feeding them to you. It was a very interesting time. I did love my time there.
It's a beautiful place.
It's absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. I highly recommend anyone to go stay there and have their wedding there.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've been there a few times, when we were talking about this, you were saying that what people would take, which was very interesting.
Yeah.
So did you want to tell the audience about some of the things that people took because they wanted a memento of the Versace?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know what I can and can't say here. It's going to get me in trouble. There were many a times where people would try to take certain things from Palazzo Versace, the hotel, and just steal that as a little memento. It would be from spoons to dinner plates.
Did you ever have to say, can you please give me back that dinner plate?
Yes.
Oh, my God, how embarrassing.
Yeah, I think that one gentleman, there was actually a camera right above him, and he denied it, and we had to say, look, there was a camera right above So, yeah, very embarrassing.
Oh, my God, for him as well.
For him, yeah. And, you know, their cutlery cost hundreds or thousands of dollars. So it's not a joke when you have people stealing things. And, yeah, it was very unexpected, but it happened routinely.
it's incredible because even my brother, he has a restaurant in a club, and they got, you know, more unusual, those double glass coffee cups, you know, to serve the coffee. It's a club, you know. I mean, within a couple of weeks, all of them went.
Yeah, you know, and he went,
I just can't believe, and that is actually a big cost of his, cutlery going, particularly cutlery, but that's more because it gets lost, but yeah, it's a huge expense for businesses.
Definitely.
You think you're the only one taking it, but if
everybody has that mindset, and the problem with that was that Palazzo Versace has their own line of crockery, so it is a lot. It's not like you're just going to a restaurant taking a pretty glass. You know, one of their little plates, the tiny little side plates, were like $300.
Yeah, that is just incredible, insane. So then you graduated and you obviously moved around a bit and you decided to get you to, well, what attracted you to the bridal industry?
It was just a case of me seeing that job and feeling connected to it. And I guess working at Versace, I thought, you know, it doesn't, on the Gold Coast, it does not get much better than weddings at Palazzo Versace.
Yeah.
You know, that's the upper echelon.
Pinnacle.
Right?
Yeah.
So when I saw this job, I just thought, okay, well, I've got so much experience on, you know, I wouldn't say bottom level, but like on a service level, and then my background in business, why not? I think that I can be really good in this position.
Because this was a national operations manager.
That's correct, yes.
So it was quite senior.
Yes.
And so what sort of business is the Australian Bridal Industry Academy?
Okay, good question. So there's a lot that's involved, but the easiest way of me trying to describe it to you is think of the Oscars, where they give out the awards for the best movies. We give out the awards for the best designer couturier, the best wedding venue, the best DJ, the best transport, and so on and so forth. So there's about 37 different categories. And the way that we determine who the winners and the finalists are purely from the ratings and reviews from their previous clients. So they essentially register the brides and grooms that they've serviced in the past 12 months. And those brides and grooms will give them a rating in 4 criteria. And then collectively, we determine who the winners and finalists are from those ratings and reviews. We also have an avenue where we provide accreditation. So if you reach a minimum average rating of 95% or above from that 4 criteria, you can become accredited with the ABIA. So when people get engaged, it's most likely it's your first time getting engaged. You have absolutely no idea who to go with. It's very easy to make a decision on who to book if you find them as an accredited partner of the ABIA, because we are a peak industry body in weddings.
So when you say you rate them and you give awards, so you must have some sort of award night or something like that.
We have state awards in 5 states, and then we have the National Designer of Dreams Awards as well.
So that would be a lot of work to go and do
lot,
that.
A lot. We have the ABIA
you still feel very much part of that, even though you've left that.
The internal database of businesses is about 15,000. So there's a lot. I think there's about 300 guests at every awards. They're all industry professionals that are at the top of their game.
And so are they invited, or do they have to pay for tickets?
They are invited. They do have to pay for tickets, and that's only because we have to pay the venues and things like that. So we don't charge exorbitant fees. Gosh, I can't even say that word.
I know, sometimes that's worse. Tricky, especially if you've had a glass of wine.
I know, but so in my defense, I've had a couple of glasses of wine and I've not had my lunch today. I was promised lunch. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, so we only charge essentially the costs involved in paying for the venue. We're very, very lucky that we have a lot of suppliers or vendors that sponsor parts of the award. So it's a gala affair, three-course dinner, black tie event. Everyone's dressed up to the nines. We usually have a band, we have stylists, we have DJs, everything that you could ever think of putting together something of that caliber is there. And people, of course, pay because it is a networking event for them. So they can market their business by attending, and they're going to raise their exposure in the wedding industry and generate profits.
Because, of course, if you're a good DJ, then the wedding venue may very well be interested in hearing from you. Is that
the
sort of
thing? Yes, you can be a preferred vendor. So especially to a venue, but more so a bride and groom is more likely. Say, for example, if you have a very high budget, if you're a bride that only wants the best of the best, or a groom that wants the best of the best.
Usually, though, it's the bride.
Sometimes it's the bride.
Or sometimes it's the parents.
Yeah, this is very true. So if there's a couple that has a very high budget, they're likely to be interested in value over price. So they want to go with the number one wedding venue or the number one designer couturier. So who do they go with? Well, they go with the businesses that have won the ABIA award.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. So you started off as national operations manager. So is there anything more that you wanted to say about how you got that job besides under-negotiating?
It was as simple as that. I just went in there and I just said to him, I need a break. This is my background. This is what I believe I can bring to the company. You know, what are your key objectives? I think that I'll be able to reach those key objectives. And should we do this or not?
And so what were some of the challenges for you because of your age and relative inexperience?
I think I was very mature for my age as well, because I was an only child and I studied so much and I met so many different people, and I don't think I ever thought of myself as inexperienced. I never had that mentality. My only mentality was to be good at what I was doing. And yeah, I guess that's pretty much it.
Yeah, so you didn't... Well, how many of you were there in the team?
Oh, my gosh, at that point, I can't even remember. That was 7 years ago.
Because, you know, that's... I mean, I would have thought some people would have had real problems with your age and being, you know, their boss.
Never... The ABIA is fantastic in the sense that there is no hierarchy, per se. And John, the ABIA chairman, who's recently retired, he's the one that set the tone for that. So I always saw John as equally my mentor, equally my friend, equally my boss, equally my support system. And same as his daughter, Natasha O'Mara, who's recently took charge of the ABIA as the managing director. I've co-collaborated with her for 7 years, and it's the same thing. I never thought that she was above me. I never thought that, you know, there was any type of hierarchy.
It's a very flat structure in a sense, yes,
because I think that teams work better when they feel like everyone's respected on the same level. I guess if I can give you an example, when we do go to these awards that are, you know, very well-respected awards, I make a point to sit on the registration desk. And the way that someone will speak to me on a registration desk versus when they find out who I am is very different.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can see straight away that when you start having titles, people act differently.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know when I really noticed that, Angelica, was when I had my child. And, you know, if people knew that I was a lawyer, the way that they would treat me was different. But when I had a child, and particularly because she had a disability, and I went to the hospital, and I was just treated like worse than a mother. It was a mother of a child with a disability, which is, it was awful, you know. And you sort of realise then that people do treat you differently because... And it's not really it's not a really true reflection of who you are. You shouldn't be, you should not treat people differently.
No.
Because you either think that they have something that they can get from you,
mm.
or, you know, for any, I find that really offensive,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah, unfortunately it does happen. So, yeah, I think that John very early on made the decision that he was going to run his company in a certain way, and I think that he's done that very, very well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it's I think it's really increased in size and scope, hasn't
mm.
it, over
yeah.
the 9 years that
yeah.
you've been there, because
mm-hmm.
it did, there's a lot more people that are on their books, so to
yes.
speak, since that you came aboard.
Yes.
So, within 6 months of joining the ABIA,
yeah.
we always love acronyms, don't we?
It's too much of a mouthful. Hello, my name is Angelique. I'm calling from the Australian Bridal Industry Academy. like, what are you saying?
So now it's the Australian Bridal.
So it's the Australian Bridal Industry Academy,
mm-hmm.
But the acronym is ABIA Weddings. And the reason why we've done that is we want everyone to feel inclusive. We felt as though using the word bridal excludes gay and lesbian couples. So we're proactively doing everything that we can to make everyone feel inclusive. And this is just a little something that we can do. I mean, changing the name of your business is huge. So we're hoping that that is, you know, a point that people can see that we want to lead the way. We think it's very, very important that for a business like this who has a very loud voice in the market, we have to do something. And we're trying as best as we can. We're here always to receive feedback. So if there's anything else that we can do in any terms, any cultural weddings or whatever it may be, to be better and be more inclusive, then they're always there with open arms to take on any constructive criticism.
I wouldn't have thought that, you know, like, I mean, it's, you know, sometimes when you're a heterosexual person, you are very arrogant. You don't think that some of the language would be
yeah.
quite
It's
upsetting.
Just natural,
yeah.
isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when you think about it, grooms might also be involved in this,
yeah,
not just brides, you
know?
So, all right, so you made this shift.
Yes.
How did you make that shift and why such a meteoric rise?
Okay, so the time that I came into the ABIA, I know that there was a bit of a transition, and we kind of were at a point where we really needed to work fast to scale the business to make a lot of money to get it to where it needed to be. And I think it was a combination of luck, timing, experience and everything. But I remember sitting down with the chairman and just racking my brain thinking, what are we going to do? What tools in the artillery can we use to propel this company to where it needs to be? And it just so happened that it was during the rise of Facebook.
Uh-huh.
This was 9 years ago. I sat down day and night trying to figure out how to develop a campaign using Facebook and its algorithms to generate profit, and I managed to do that. And within a very short space of time, I was able to increase company revenue by a very significant amount. And off the back of that, I guess I was rewarded.
I do know.
Yeah.
So Facebook, it was really quite transformational.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. And I was very lucky that back in those days, I had a lot of direct contact with Facebook. And I was able to develop my campaigns to a point where they were, you know, as perfect as they could get, and generated quite a bit of money, not just for the ABIA, but for our clients as well, in terms of generating leads and sales and marketing and things like that. And as time has gone on, I just have perfected the process as much as could be. And same thing with the campaign. Originally, it was called the Bride to Be campaign. And then we changed that to encompass both brides and grooms and started calling it the Bride and Groom campaign. So, Yeah, that kind of gives you a little bit of insight as to what happened back in the day,
yeah.
I would like to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess for us, we were advertising traditional mediums like print media, expos, and it was just a very heavy, old, clunky way of advertising.
Mm.
And I just brought a fresh perspective. Not to make it sound easy, because Facebook advertising is probably the most hardest thing to wrap your head around. There are a lot of businesses that just think it's as easy as putting a little bit of money on Facebook and it's as easy as that, and it definitely is not. There's a reason why I work 8 hours a day in my role, because you can't just spend 5 minutes a day doing something on Facebook and expecting
results. I might talk to you a little bit after the podcast about how to increase my exposure. So, I mean, it really sounds, you really talk about this business so much with so much passion.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, and you've really enjoyed yourself in that role.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a decade of my life.
And you still think of it.
Us.
Say it's us,
I think it will be forever. I think that no matter what, and I even had this conversation with John's daughter, Natasha O'Mara, who's the managing director now, we will in some capacity always be together. Whatever that means, you know, we've watched each other grow. We've been like sisters and helped each other just organically and naturally. It hasn't been like, hey, can you help me do this? Hey, can you help me do that? It's just we've always worked so closely together. And, yeah, it's just it's a decade of my life. You know, it's very hard to walk away from that, and that was not an easy decision by any means.
So why did you do it?
Why?
Why?
Do you know what? I think the catalyst was when I found out the ABIA chairman, John, was stepping down. And I felt like if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. It's like when a change happens, you change everything, you know? And although I wanted to be the support system there for Natasha, I just thought, you know, I'm at that age in my life where I'm in my early 30s, I'm not married and I don't have children. I need to find that next chapter of my life. And I don't know what that next chapter of my life is. I know that I love business. I'm very strong at sales and marketing. But what's next? I feel like, you know, I've reached the pinnacle at the ABIA. So I need to follow a new avenue. And, you know, I'll always dip my toes in the ABIA.
So it's nice to take a bit of risk, isn't it?
Yes.
You know?
That's the hardest thing.
It is really risky. You know, especially with your background.
Yeah.
I don't envy you that choice. Like, it, you know, I mean, with the German background, we're not risk takers.
Yeah.
We like security.
Yeah, yeah. Safe to say, I don't think my mum approved. She's going
glad
to listen to this and be so upset that I said
that. Glad to see that she's following the mold of a good European woman.
No, she's amazing. She's just
I'm sure
amazing.
That she's your greatest supporter.
She is, yeah.
So if you were going to say what is the best thing that your law degree has given you?
100% discipline. Just being able to expand my mind. There's so many things. The people that you meet, the things that you read. I mean, you have to work hard to become a lawyer. It is not easy. I don't think people realize. And I don't think that I was naturally born intelligent by any stretch of the imagination. So for me, it was very hard.
Humble,
it was very, very hard. It was so hard. But I was just so determined. And I thought, you know what? If I can do this, I can do anything. Because it's not as simple as just learning. It's giving up your life. You know, there was so many chunks of time in my life where I couldn't go out and party with my friends. I couldn't do what I needed to do. And
well, what you wanted to do.
Or what,
you
sorry,
always
what
did,
I wanted to
you
do.
You always did what you needed to do.
This is
what
true,
you wanted
what
to
I
do.
What I wanted to do. And it is, you know, a lot of it is thanks to my parents that they never, ever, ever said to me that I had to work whilst I study.
Mm.
They said, as long as you're studying, you don't need to work. If you want to, you can. But I'm very lucky that I had that support system there.
I think it's the backup, isn't it? It's not, you know, like I've often known people who've said to me, look, you know, when things have gone wrong in their life, they didn't have anywhere to go.
Yeah.
No one to ask for $20. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you know, European parents can be difficult, but you know that they are there.
Yeah.
You know, they've got your back.
Yeah,
100%. And that's what you want.
Yeah, that's one thing I never, ever, ever had to question. So I'm very lucky.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about networking, because how important do you think that's been in furthering your career, and especially how did you leverage that in the ABIA? And what tips can you give me?
I think that the biggest tip that I can give you is, we briefly spoke about this before we started the interview, is to say yes to things.
Mm.
And it's very hard to say yes to things. You know, there's so many things that come into play. Anxiety. If I can just touch on anxiety for a second, I had anxiety before anxiety was a thing. Everyone seems to have anxiety these days. For me, anxiety was, and my mum can attest to this, the first time I ever went on stage when I was 6 years old and had to throw up. The first time I ever caught a bus to school and I had to throw up. Mm. The first time I was ever in a classroom. All of these firsts. Like, for me, anxiety, you know, was just on another level. So to just sit, meditate and be one with myself and say, look, I need to go speak to someone. And whether it means going through that anxiety and having that sense of I'm going to be sick, getting over it and still doing it, you just have to push through. And it's uncomfortable. You don't need to have anxiety for it to feel uncomfortable, but you just have to go out and say hello to someone.
Mm.
You know, there's been so many times where people have said to me, oh my gosh, I never thought you would be like you are. And when I say, what do you mean by that? Like, oh, you kind of just don't look like a nice person. And I think that's just because I've got, you know, that resting mean face sometimes. So
you can call it a resting bitch face.
Yeah, I don't want to say that, but that's
too rated.
So I get told that all the time. So I feel like I need to work harder sometimes to, not to be fake, because I'm never fake, but just to let people know that I am nice and, you know, I'm always here to help you as much as I can. Because for me, a lot of the milestones in my life, I didn't get to them without mentors.
Mm.
So those mentors never wanted anything from me. No. They never said, I'm doing this because of this. So the only way that I feel like I can live my life now is by giving back to people, whether that's by giving them 5 minutes of my time or giving them a month or whatever it is. Everyone has to do something. So networking is great for me. I get to speak to people and learn about what their needs are, and that helps me as like a quote-unquote business consultant, so I can see where people need to improve, and it helps me perfect my skills, basically.
I think it's a, you know, seriously, I don't like it when people say, oh, you know, like, it's fake or whatever, because I don't think you do anything in life without some, you know, even if you do something out of an completely altruistic, of course you get something back.
Yeah, you feel good about yourself.
You feel good about yourself.
Yeah, that's getting something back. Yeah.
So, you know, and I think it's true. If you can do something for somebody else, and you can always learn from somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
I swear to you, you can learn from anyone.
And, you know, it's hard because it depends on settings as well.
Yeah.
I feel like in certain settings, like in group scenarios, I definitely am not as confident as I am one-on-one.
Yeah.
So I think you just need to find out what flows for you. Mm. And if you feel like you're better one-to-one, you know what? Just message that person and ask them for a cup of coffee.
Mm.
They're not going to say no. They won't. I guarantee you. And if they do, then you don't want a bar of people like that.
No.
You know
and
I mean?
It's so true. You're right about that. So often I've asked for things and people have said yes, and I've been really surprised. But then again, if somebody asks me,
you'd say yes.
Of course.
Yeah, there you go. We forget.
Yeah.
You know, we forget that, of course, we would go above and beyond for someone and they would do the same for us. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask you, because in your free time, you like enjoy Pilates.
Yes.
And that's how I got to meet you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Angelica and I did a Pilates
workshop
together.
Yes.
That my niece ran.
Yes.
So why do you like Pilates?
Okay, so I've always had back problems, and studying didn't make it better because I would study in my bed.
That is
yes,
so bad.
And progressively my back got worse and worse and worse, and then I ended up getting my scans done and I found out I had scoliosis. And I was just one of your typical gym junkies that would go to the gym for 2 hours a day, and I thought my life was fantastic. And then the chiro and my physical therapist said, "You can never go to the gym ever again."
Oh,
like,
you're kidding me.
Yeah.
They actually said
Wait,
that.
I have a European background. I like to eat. This is the end of my life. But I was like, no, you can't say this to me.
You're so much like me, because that's the reason why I exercise. I want to eat.
Right? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. No, I love food. So, yes, I was very upset to get that diagnosis. But basically, they said, you know, these are your options. And I was like, no, you know what? I'm going to do Pilates. And I know whatever I set my mind to, I'm just going to be the best at. So I ended up, coming to Pilates and did all different types of Pilates and got on a thing called ClassPass, which is like an app that you can get on your phone. And you can go do any classes. That's probably my app going off now. And you can go to all different classes around wherever you are. And I was just super embarrassed to go to any classes, so I started out doing YouTube videos of Pilates.
Why were you super embarrassed?
I just
don't
like,
you look great.
But I don't like being in crowds. I don't like people looking at me when I'm doing wrong. So I thought I'd get to a level where I'm okay at it. And then I ended up doing Pilates, and then I ended up taking Kat's class, or Nisa's class, and it changed my life. It really genuinely changed my life. Like, I have a lot to owe to her. The way she carries out her classes, there's so much warmth and friendliness to it. And when you have to do a hot Pilates class for 60 minutes on a Friday night, you must really love your teacher. And I really, really do. So, that's why I do Pilates, because I want to be healthy and strong.
Yeah, and that's a lovely story. But obviously you do a bit of meditation as well.
Yes.
How important has meditation been for you in getting balance in your life?
It is important. I think everybody meditates in a different kind of way. I don't know if people would say the way I meditate is like a true form of meditation, but what I do is every morning when I wake up, I'm one of those people that naturally wakes up at 5:40.
Yeah.
I don't have a choice. No. I just wake up. And I do an hour of stretching. And whilst I'm stretching, it's a very slow stretch. So I meditate in that state.
Yeah.
But if I had to sit here and meditate, it just wouldn't happen.
Well, you know, that's what they say. A lot of the yoga practices are moving meditations.
Yes.
For that reason.
Yeah.
You know, because they are supposed to be. It's supposed to be about calming the mind rather than anything else. Now, what is some practical advice you would give someone who is looking to make a career in sales and marketing? You can see this comes from my question list.
Okay.
But, yeah.
I didn't even think about this question. Practical advice.
I didn't tell you, really.
No. No. I mean, in what sense? I guess as a business person?
Well, just, you know, I mean, sometimes people, they see you. They see how you got there.
Yeah.
How did you get here? Like, what would be something that you could say?
Okay.
A couple of tips,
Okay, well, I'm finding that a lot of girls that are in their early 20s are, like, trying to be entrepreneurs now.
Mm.
You really cannot focus on what you're seeing on Instagram and Facebook. That's smoke and mirrors.
Mm.
Honestly, it's smoke and mirrors. Please, just don't even look at that. What you need to do is you need to become the best at what you do.
My apologies, it's my phone.
You just really need to be good at what you do, and you can become the best by learning. You can learn anything from Google, really. And it's not about just typing something in and reading the first thing that comes up. You have to do a lot of investigation. And if you want to try opening up your business, see what the pitfalls are.
And I think it's true, you do need content, you need to have some substance, you know, so you can't just go, like you said, pretty looks can be good, but they're not going to get you ongoing audience.
There's been so many workshops that I've gone to just, I guess, out of curiosity. And, you know, the content they provided these workshops, I'm just like, are you kidding me? We really all need to just stand up and just say, look, we need to be better collectively. We can't sell these packages to these people that are opening up their businesses and thinking, oh, you know, this is the next social media sensation. They know what they're talking about. It's not as easy as that. Anything that comes that easy is not real.
No, you know? And it's not sustainable. All right, so now we're now for Angelica. Is that right?
Yes, Angelica. Where now? Good question. In the short term, I am literally going on holidays within the next couple of days. I'll be finishing up with the ABIA this week. And whilst I'm on holidays, I think I'll just think about what the next chapter is. I love business. I love everything to do with business. So I'm sure that you'll either see me being a business consultant for someone or maybe starting my own business. We'll see.
For the next chapter.
Yeah, do you continue?
Clink our glasses.
Yeah, well, thank you. Nazdravia, as we say.
Thank you, Angelica. That was wonderful. And until next time, this is Lunching with Lawyers.
Thank you for joining us on Lunching with Lawyers. If you enjoyed this episode or have questions or comments for our guests, head to the show notes for this episode and click on the contact links below. If you have suggestions, ideas or questions, or would even like to be part of this series, head to the Contact Us page on our website, www.loretacrete.com.